I'm Carol Coletta, and this is Smart City. Today on the show, we explore the stubborn link between race and poverty in America. My guest, Professor Pedro Noguera, has written a book about the cultural, societal, and personal factors that cause young Black and Hispanic males to run afoul of middle-class American norms. Professor Noguera joins us to discuss his book, The Trouble with Black Boys. And we'll talk with Thomas Sevcik about how much work it can take to change the way the world views a city. Thomas is the founder of the internationally acclaimed creative studio, Arthesia, and he'll tell us about the complicated issue of a city's identity and how to find what he calls the city's drama. All that, plus the latest news from Nate Berg at Planet Edison and our City Views commentator, Walker Smith, coming up on today's Smart City, right after this news. You're listening to Smart City. I'm Carol Coletta. My first guest, Pedro Noguera, is no stranger when it comes to racial conflict and controversy. As the executive director of the Metropolitan Center for Urban Education and as a professor at NYU, he studied the ways schools are influenced by social and economic conditions in an urban environment. He's also a father and an educator, and he's brought his wide range of experience to his latest book, The Trouble with Black Boys. What is the trouble with Black boys?
I use the title, The Trouble with Black Boys, in a provocative way, both to kind of acknowledge that on most of the indicators that we associate with academic and even behavioral success in school, Black males are more likely to be in trouble than not within school, but also to raise the question, what's the cause of that trouble and why? Why is it that Black males in this country seem to be often identified with trouble in various ways? And so the title, which some people have actually reacted to because some people see it as a way of targeting the boys, which is actually the opposite of what I'm trying to do, is designed to try to raise the question, what is the trouble? Why is it going on? And I do it purposefully because I think it is almost commonplace now to assume that Black males are going to be in trouble, more likely to be disciplined, more likely to be punished and failing academically or dropping out of school or not in honors courses or overrepresented in special ed classes. And I raise it because I think we have to understand to what degree the schools we've created have contributed to these patterns of failure. I don't want to put all the blame on schools because I think it's not simply a school issue. I think it has a lot to do with our society and the stereotypes of Black males that are pervasive in American society that result in lowered expectations and result in even Black males embracing stereotypes that allow themselves to be pigeonholed and to be viewed in a very distorted manner.
In the book, you tell a story about your own son and how, despite being raised in a middle-class family with two supportive parents, his behavior started to change in the 10th grade. Tell me what happened.
Well, my son, Joaquin, who is now a teacher, but at the time was a promising student in high school, when he hit 10th grade, I noticed a real change in his behavior. It first started showing up with challenging behavior in school and then at home, and then lowered grades, poor behavior in school, he started getting in trouble. And this was a real change because he had been a very successful student in school. He was an athlete. He was a musician. He was doing all the things that you would typically associate with success. And so that sudden downturn seemed out of the ordinary. But as I probed and tried to understand, and I did that largely by spending time with him, and this is something I always encourage parents. A lot of times parents, when they see one of their children, particularly the boys, getting into trouble, instead of embracing them, they push them away even further. I spent more time with him to try to figure out what was going on, and that's when I realized it was two things that were happening for him. One was the effect of the peer groups. The boys he'd gone to school with were all doing much worse in school than he was. And kids often judge themselves in relation to those they identify with. That is, the frame of reference for him was not other middle-class kids, but the kids on the block that he grew up with who at that point were either failing in school or had dropped out of school. So he was saying that relative to them, he was doing okay. The other part of it, though, was when he left our home, a home that was nurturing and supportive, he had to confront streets that were often hostile. He had to confront attitudes and expectations of him as a young Black man that made him seem like a threat. And he also had to confront the fact that if he did not carry himself in a way that suggested that he was not able to handle himself, that he could be victimized. And it's important that it was important for me as a parent and for my wife at the time as a to understand the world that he had to inhabit, that he had to walk through and navigate. And I think similarly, it's important for parents and to teachers to understand the challenges our boys face both in school and outside of school.
Well, it's one thing to understand it, but it's another to do something about it. How do we do something about it?
Well, I'll use, again, my son as a case to explain what we did about it. A lot of what we had to do was to really increase his exposure so that he didn't simply identify with the kids on the block, kids who, incidentally, he'd grown up with, who were good friends of his, and nothing was wrong with them except that many of them did not have parents who could provide the same degree of support. We had to make sure that he was also interacting with young people who were college-bound, who were continuing on a much more positive path. Because, again, as children enter adolescence, the peer groups they're in exert a powerful influence over them. We also had to make sure that we continued to expose him to experiences that deliberately broke the stereotypes. And we know that in this country, the stereotypes of black males in particular tend to reinforce athletics. They reinforce negative behavior, like drug dealing and the like. We had to expose him to young people who were involved in music, in theater, who were serious about scholarship. We were lucky because we were able to travel to other countries in the world so he could see that he was not merely a member of the community where he lived, but really see himself as a citizen of the world, as a person who had great opportunity available to him so that his aspirations and his sense of who he was could expand. And I think that that's a part of what we've got to do for boys. We've got to not allow their identity to become narrowed and to become distorted by the stereotypes that are pervasive in American society.
And, of course, I think that's always been a challenge, not only with African-American males, but certainly with women at one point. I mean, now women are succeeding in school and completing, you know, at a rate that's higher than men. But that was not always the case. It seems to me the problem you had with your son is exactly why a lot of people struggle to get their kids out of schools where most of the kids are not succeeding. They want them to have other role models. You were able to give your son the exposure to additional experiences, additional people, additional even geography. But many parents can't do that. Is there a societal response? Is there a public response to this problem of this vicious cycle of failure among African American males and what we expect of them, which then produces more failure?
Well, the point you raised about girls, I think, is one that we can learn a very important lesson from. Up until the 1990s, the major concern we had about girls is that girls were not doing as well academically, that there was bias in schools, and that the stereotypes of girls were limiting their options. Today, if you talk to young women and you ask young women, what do you want to be when you grow up? You won't hear nurse or flight attendant or teacher as the only options. Today, girls think they can be whatever they want. And it's not to say that girls are not still affected by stereotypes related to body type and beauty and things like that. They are. But their aspirations about who they can be and what they can be have completely changed. We've got to do the same thing with black, and I would add, Hispanic boys, and even many white working class boys, whose notions of masculinity have been confined and narrowed, and who often find themselves gravitating towards sports or towards activities which don't allow them to grow and develop as fully balanced human beings. And I think schools have to play a role in ensuring that we are providing young people with opportunities to develop talents that may not be nurtured. Think about how many schools will put so much emphasis on football and basketball, but will not encourage the same boys to excel in mathematics or robotics or music. And those are the kinds of activities that actually break stereotypes.
What did we do differently for women? What happened that changed their perspectives on what they could be, changed their aspirations on what they could do in life?
Well, what happened for girls and for young women was there was a women's movement. It was a women's movement that started. It existed throughout society, but it also existed most importantly in the home. Today, there are a lot more men who are washing dishes and doing chores and raising children than there ever were before. And that was because women insisted on it. Women said, listen, if you're going to be my husband, if you're going to be the father of these kids, you've got to share the responsibility. And as men, the attitudes shifted in the home. And, of course, this is not something that's happened completely. There are a lot of homes where these stereotypes are still very much in place. But as they've changed, and as girls, the identity of girls also changed, it increased the possibilities for girls to expand their horizons and to explore new avenues of who they are. So that if you look at young women in school, this notion that girls can't be a pilot or can't be a scientist, they're pretty much gone now. It's the reason why Larry Summers, when he suggested, when he was president of Harvard, that women could not do science and math because of something biological, was roundly condemned, not just by women, but many others, because he was basically just repeating an old stereotype that had already been proven to be untrue. Unfortunately, for black and Hispanic men in this country, those stereotypes are still very pervasive, and they're reinforced by social norms. The fact is that when you turn on TV on a Sunday afternoon, you're going to see 90% of the football players are black. And that's true in the NBA. And that sends a very powerful message to our boys about what they can be and how they should invest their time. We need to consciously expose boys to other role models and other examples of success than many of them are ever have a chance to be exposed to.
There are schools where African-American male students do well. What is it they're doing differently?
There are schools where African-American males do well, and that's what I would say the solution lies. We need to study those schools. We need to understand what they're doing. One of the things they're doing is they're providing young men with role models of various kinds who can show them how to become men and in a more complete sense, how to become fathers. If you're a boy who doesn't have a father at home, you don't fully understand what does it mean to be a father and not simply have babies, but to actually raise them, to actually care for them. Schools where you see boys thriving, black boys thriving, you're seeing a deliberate effort made to break stereotypes, a deliberate effort made to cultivate strong, caring relationships with teachers and counselors and other adults who can show them how to be successful and don't merely stand as judges over them. You're seeing schools that are consciously working to expand their access to the curriculum to make sure that they are taking rigorous courses, that they do develop a love of reading and writing. You know, in some ways, it's what all schools should do. The sad thing is that it doesn't happen nearly enough.
Well, and I think no school, no teacher, no principal would ever say, we don't want to do that. They all want to do it, but it's not happening. Why isn't it happening?
It doesn't happen because it takes a concerted effort. It takes a deliberate effort to consciously undo those stereotypes, to consciously create an environment that is a stereotype-free zone, create an environment where boys, like girls, are being challenged, are being included and nurtured, that we don't use discipline in merely a punitive matter, but we use discipline to build character, where we actually teach boys how to conduct themselves in school and outside of school, that when we tell them to pull up their pants and take off their hood, we explain why you want to carry yourself in a dignified manner, that it's not simply about following rules, but about understanding what it takes to be successful in life. And when you go to schools where you see young boys who are being socialized and engaged in these ways, you see, you often find that you're in a loving, supportive environment. And unfortunately, that's not common enough in our schools today.
How does the experience of schools that are succeeding with African-American young men inform what we have to do to serve Latino students?
Well, I think that the patterns are fairly similar, because with Latino students, we're seeing, boys in particular, we're seeing higher rates of dropout from school. Although I would add here that for many immigrant students, the reasons why they're dropping out often have to do with the pressure in families to work. work to support themselves and support their families. But nonetheless, it results in similar patterns of academic failure. And I think we need to, again, invest much more heavily in counseling, much more heavily in building relationships with students in school, particularly Latino students in school, so that they can see education as a pathway to a better life rather than low-wage jobs, which are calling them right now.
You've talked about discipline and the need to discipline to build character. Obviously, some students need punishing. Fair statement?
Sure. There should be consequences. When you misbehave, when you do something wrong, there have got to be clear consequences. But the consequences have to be designed to teach a lesson. And the lesson can't be next time to avoid punishment. The lesson has to be with the goal of changing behavior. And if you find you're punishing the same kids over and over again, then clearly the strategy you're using is not working. And in most schools, we primarily rely on suspension to punish kids. And what ends up happening is suspension doesn't work. If kids don't like school, suspension is a reward. And so kids are at home watching television instead of being in school and learning. So we've got to be much more creative. We've got to spend time figuring out what's behind a behavior problem and then figuring out what's the lesson this child has to learn. But most of all, we have to find ways to make sure that we are keeping kids connected to learning. Because a student who's not invested in learning, a student who doesn't understand why they're in school and why they should behave, is a student that's almost impossible to discipline because they've given up. And a student who's given up is very, very difficult to handle in school.
You call for equity in public education. Tell me what equity is. How do we know equity when we see it?
You know, most parents know equity right away because they practice equity with their own children. And equity is not about treating everyone the same. Equity is about responding to the needs of individual children with a focus on outcomes. We want to make sure that all children graduate from our schools with a trajectory towards either college or a career. We want to make sure that we are meeting the individual needs of students. Some students, because they come from privileged college-educated families, will actually need less guidance than other children. Some children need much more structure, much more clarity around what's expected of them than others. And so we have to be responsive to the different needs of kids. And we have to be aware of the fact that the society we live in does not treat all children the same. If you are a young black male, you have to learn at a very early age that some people are afraid of you just by looking at you. Some of your teachers are afraid of you because you are dark, you are a man or a young man, and even if you are a wonderful, loving person, what they see when they see you is someone who's potentially a threat. And you have to make them self-aware so they know how to deal with adults, teachers, police officers, judges, employers, in ways that make it less likely that they will be judged negatively because of how they speak and how they carry themselves and how they comport themselves.
You also call, at the same time you call for equity, you also call for excellence in public education. Can you get equity and excellence at the same time?
Absolutely. And the way you do it is by showing children what excellence is. You have to show them this is what it means to write an excellent paper. Start at the end. Show them A-level work and then say this is the work that I expect of each of you. And focus much less on the grading and much more on the feedback, much more on the revisions, much more on the reworking of a problem or of a task until they got it right. We don't focus enough on mastery in school. If you think about it, when the students are learning music or theater or sports, we focus more on the performance. We want to make sure that they can shoot free throws, that they can play the instrument, that they can get the part right in the play. We have to have the same focus on mastery when we're teaching math or when we're doing science or writing, to really spend time analyzing what are they doing and are they doing it in the correct way? Are they doing it in ways that demonstrate they fully understand what's expected of them? Our kids don't see excellence nearly enough in school, not including many of our best students.
Do you do that with your own students at NYU?
Absolutely. I teach doctoral students, and I usually start with when I give them a paper, I make available samples of excellent papers so they can look at it and so they can understand this is what's expected of them when they do their research papers for my course.
Secretary of Education Arne Duncan is calling for increasing the standards for public education. Do you agree with that?
Absolutely. But higher standards is only one part of the equation. The next question is, how do you make sure that all kids and all schools have learning standards that allow the children to meet higher standards? We have some kids going to schools in this country where they don't have textbooks, where there are 35, 40 kids in a classroom, where they have teachers who are not qualified to teach the subjects. What kind of standards are those? Those are third world standards. Those standards are should be unacceptable for the Secretary of Education, and he should be outraged that some children in this country go to schools that allow with such a substandard education, including in his old district in Chicago.
You call for transforming urban schools through investments in social capital. What do you mean by that?
Well, if you think about part of what makes some students successful is their connection to powerful people. They know someone who will write them a letter for college. They know someone who will give them access to a job or an opportunity that's going to look good on their resume later on. Poor kids frequently don't have access to powerful adults, don't have access to someone who knows someone who can get them into college or who can get them that summer internship. That's what more kids, particularly in the inner city, need. They need to be connected to powerful and influential adults who can open doors.
Pedro, thanks so much for being our guest on Smart City.
Thank you.
Pedro Noguera is a professor at the Steinhardt School of Culture, Education, and Human Development at New York University. His book is called The Trouble with Black Boys and Other Reflections on Race, Equity, and the Future of Public Education. Our interview was engineered by Amber Cortez. And now, for the latest news in the world of urban planning and design, we turn to Nate Berg of Plan Edison.
Planners and urban policy wonks got downright giddy last fall when then-President-elect Barack Obama announced his plans to create a cabinet-level office focusing on urban issues. The White House Office of Urban Policy was heralded across the country as a long-missing element of the executive strategy. But now, almost 6 months after it was announced, the anticipated office has yet to really take shape. The online magazine The Root reports on the lack of action, citing that only two positions in the office have been named. Creating the office was a good idea for Obama, who won over city voters by more than 27 points in the 2008 election. And about 80% of Americans now live in metropolitan or non-rural areas, so there's definitely a built-in demand for urban policy guidance. But with cities across the country struggling through the economic recession, many say now is exactly the time that an urban-focused office should be kicking into action. Meanwhile, out in Providence, Rhode Island, a new city park is being called an unlikely success. Critic David Broussat wrote recently in the Providence Journal about the park space built beneath a new bridge over the Providence River. Though a dark spot beneath an interstate bridge might not seem like an ideal place for a park, Broussat writes that the design created a new hidden gem for the city. Primarily concrete, it appears almost brutalist, according to Broussat, but is still able to retain a welcoming feel. The space is not your typical park, but with views of the river and the beautiful new bridge, it actually turns out to be a nice place to spend some time. And in the end, that's really the only metric you need to evaluate a park. And in other park news, a new mapping project is hoping to tap into the knowledge of the nation to map out all the playgrounds in the U.S. The 100,000 Play Spaces in 100 Days campaign is calling on people to contribute to a collaborative map of playgrounds, sports fields, and skate parks. The intended result is a countrywide map of play spaces, creating a better vision of where park networks exist and where they're badly needed. According to a recent article from Next American City, the mapping project will turn into a powerful tool for planners and neighborhood activists, especially in cities where park spaces are lacking. Though generating the funding for park projects may be tough right now, at least communities will know where they should go when they can afford them again. For Plan Edison, I'm Nate Berg.
Nate Berg is the assistant editor of PlanEdison.com. Coming up after the break, we'll talk with architect, designer, and branding expert Thomas Sevcik. He'll tell us how he helps cities discover their unique story and how to turn that into a brand. I'm Carol Coletta. Hello to our podcast listeners. I just had a quick note about some of the conversations that are happening on our social networking site, My City, our listeners are continuing to talk about the topics we bring up on the show. From rent control to mass transit, from your favorite online urbanism tools, to why you choose to live in the city in the first place. My City is a place where people who love cities can meet and chat and get great new ideas. Please join us. Send an email to our producer, Scotty Iseri, at scotty@smartcityradio.com. He'll get you all set up. And now, back to the show. You're listening to Smart City. I'm Carol Coletta. My next guest is a designer, thinker, and speaker, and I had the pleasure of being on a panel with him at the Global City Conference in Abu Dhabi on the subject of place branding. Thomas Sevchuk is the chief executive officer of Arthesia, a creative studio in Zurich, Switzerland. Thomas, you and I presented together recently at the Global City Conference in Abu Dhabi on the subject of place branding. Branding is one big challenge for most cities. What is the key to doing it right?
The key to doing it right is actually to allow a lot of time. The difficulty is that branding nowadays is still seen as a quick exercise where you do a logo or a tagline and then you make a manual and then you think it's over. Actually, this is just the beginning, and probably for cities, not even a logo or tagline is enough or is actually probably suitable. So I think the key to successful branding or identity creation is time. Allow yourself time. If you look at successful repositioning of cities or urban regions or even countries, they took years. We human beings have a lot of stereotypes, and they don't change overnight. So don't think that you can do a little campaign, a couple of commercials, a little nice logo, and then everything changes. So time is crucial, and I would say also, you usually have fragmented stakeholders in cities. You know, you have tourism people, you have business people, you have, politicians, you have the public who's interested in how a city is positioned and has an identity. And these groups have all different interests. And so it's quite difficult to have them under one idea. And this needs time and needs a very comprehensive approach. So there is no quick fix.
Well, there's no quick fix. And yet many city branding campaigns are notable only because they're so unmemorable. Why do cities continue to get this wrong?
The biggest misunderstanding is that in many cases, the branding is actually done for themselves. It's actually an interior looking approach. So I brand, let's say in a very traditional way, a city basically to assure myself that I've done a lot and now, probably the world sees my city different and look at how we are now, using the same logo or using the same tagline or probably the same imagery or wording or so. And it's reassurance to the inside. And often is never looked at what is the impact outside, actually. And so many of these, again, quick fixes actually reassure the people dealing with this and never really address questions about is it really received or how is it received on the outside or is it even recognized? I mean, I've seen branding and branding campaigns and advertising campaigns who had no impact at all. And this is the biggest obstacle to overcome. It's you don't brand it for yourself. It's like you as a person or a company, you don't make a brand so you are happy with it. Your customer or your audience needs to be happy with it. So this is, I think, where most of these or many of these campaigns or strategies fail. They address pat on the back and say, great, we have something, and they don't really look at the outside view.
Where do you begin to develop a place brand? What is the first question you ask?
We usually ask two questions in the beginning. First of all is, we ask a city, what is your drama? Now, this sounds a little theatrical or so. We believe that every city has a unique feature, a unique formula. Otherwise, it wouldn't be successful, right? I mean, every city is a city because it grew from probably being a village or a small port or whatever. And so they did something right. Otherwise, it wouldn't be a city. And there is a formula, and we strongly believe that this drama, this eternal drama, this kind of essence is a conflict. For example, you know, I've seen cities who have conflicts between we want to provide very, very good life quality, but at the same time, very dynamic way of doing business, which is a conflict. You know, it's easy to see, to put together. So this paradox almost is probably like a drama. And we ask, the first question is, what is a drama? What is your eternal essence really in the core? And then we say, please don't come with, we have great culture, or we have wonderful, rich history. You know, every city has a rich history or has a lot of restaurants or interesting, eclectic nightlife. Otherwise, it wouldn't be a city. So this is the first question. The second question we ask is, what kind of story out of this do you want to tell the world? What are the themes? What are the areas? And areas, I don't mean culture or business, economy or life quality. These are elements every city has. So what is your unique story or your take on that? And this is not easy. You know, it looks always simple, but it's quite difficult because, again, coming back to the example of great restaurants or wonderful cultural life, every city is telling you this. So this is not a differentiator. So what is the real story? So these two questions, kind of the drama and the story, are in the beginning.
Let's talk about a couple of case studies from your firm. First, talk about the work that you developed for Zurich.
Well, Zurich kind of was in a situation which is quite similar to a lot of cities, actually here in North America as well. And it's a quite successful business city. You know, it's well connected. It's a world city, major Fortune 500 headquarters. Big airport, own airline. So I would compare Zurich to a small but very internationally connected and powerful city. On the other side, Zurich for years had this kind of image of being more like a banker's town, little boring or probably a little, well, nice life quality, yes, it's clear near the Alps, but you know, the Swiss are a little boring. It's kind of, it's not really kind of exciting and all the stuff, but you could live there well and you do your business. So I would probably compare it on the North American continent a little bit with probably Toronto, who for a long time probably even has this image. I don't know, Minneapolis to a certain degree, Atlanta or so, corporate cities. And so the idea was, how do we make it more exciting and more interesting, but without losing the identity or without telling, and this is a very important point, without having to tell a story which is not true. So basically the idea was, and this is what the people in Zurich understood, and again, it was a fragmented group of people, you know, business leaders, tourism people, politicians, private people who were just interested in, basically saying, we don't want just another logo or we don't want a campaign. Actually, we don't have the money for it. You know, the Swiss are very frugal, so they're not going to spend millions in a CNN campaign or so. And we came up with the idea, let's have a strategy book, almost like a cookbook or a basic book where we describe what the drama and the story of Zurich is. Some of it is aspirational, so we're not there yet, but some of it is already been seen. And this idea of this book and this kind of project who grew out of this book is basically that everybody who is dealing with creating the image of Zurich, which sometimes are people who don't know they're actually doing it, universities, airports, all other people. So not only the tourism marketing people are creating the image. Actually, every citizen is creating a city's image when she or he travels outside and at dinner or lunch tells about the city. And so we try to have this story being used by everyone that can make their own interpretation of the story, but can use it. So it's less a visual or a marketing brochure type of thing. It's more a thinking and strategy exercise, but with very, very clear implementation strategies, ranging from strengthening the creative sector, new initiatives. We created a new magazine, yes, also communication tools, new magazine, a new film, but everything together always under a story strategy with a very, very long-term approach.
And you've also worked recently in Phoenix.
Absolutely. We're still working actually in Phoenix. Phoenix approached us being quite impressed by the Zurich example. Phoenix has similar or let's say challenges. First of all, it's also a very fragmented region. Like Zurich, Phoenix, you know, consists of, yes, one bigger city, but then a lot of smaller but very powerful and very proud cities. Scottsdale comes into mind, Tempe, where the university is, you know, new cities around Phoenix who grow, or at least were growing phenomenally in the last couple of years. And at the same time, they were realizing, oh, we are now in the fourth or fifth largest city or urban metropolitan area in the United States. we're not known in the world. People wouldn't write down Phoenix if they would have to name, you know, the major U.S. cities or so. So they have to compete on a global stage. You know, competition among cities is now global. It's global because you have to compete for talents, you have to compete for investments, for tourists. So Phoenix is on a global stage. And so they approached us and were very interested by the Zurich approach because they understood one thing. It's not done with a nice campaign in Good Magazine or in other magazines. It's not done with an advertising campaign or with a new logo. It's actually done when we are in Phoenix are defining who we are and what kind of story I'm going to tell to the world. So we're working with Phoenix now since a couple of years. It came out actually of the cultural sector and now is very broadly supported by the business community, the cultural community, and let's say the power brokers in the city. And it's moving on. And it's impressive how the people in Phoenix hang on to this, even in this economically difficult times, understanding that this is probably a good time actually to reposition a city and having the long-term stamina to really put Phoenix on the map with a new positioning.
You mentioned the fragmentation of the Phoenix metro area. There are very distinctive cities in that metro area, and they're different from one another. So how do you approach the task, Thomas, of developing a coherent story for the Phoenix metro area and yet acknowledge the differences among the various cities there?
Well, our approach is basically, as I was mentioning this story, our approach is let's have one story but allow different interpretation of this story. It's a little bit like when you have a cookbook and basically say everybody has to prepare his meal out of this book, but can make a little differentiation on it. You know, you season it differently or your vegetables, you do them a little bit in a different way. So basically the idea is to say we have an overriding story and then each of the cities and even each of these interest groups can say, yes, I take this story. This is kind of where they have to agree to say, okay, yes, we support this story and now we make an interpretation. So I'll give you an example. The Phoenix, and it was all centered around the idea of opportunity oasis in Phoenix. Now, we basically say Scottsdale has a different take on that than, you know, City of Phoenix or probably the tourism than the business community. But what is the interpretation of an opportunity oasis story for Scottsdale compare what it is for Mesa or Tempe or Glendale? So we basically went out and had workshops in all areas, in the West Valley, in all of these different cities, and asked them, okay, what is your interpretation of this story? And together, this almost creates like a mosaic, like a picture, like an image, like a self-resembling thing, where from different angle you see the same story. And this is what we strongly believe in, because there is one important thing, and you, Carol, said at the conference in Abu Dhabi, so cities talk back. You know, I remember this phrase, it's a very good phrase, because it shows that, you know, conventional branding, where you put it on a mineral water bottle or a sneaker or a car, well, this car has to live with, you know, what's called and how it looks like. The people in the cities, these are, you know, this is a living environment, this is dynamic, and also these various stakeholders. Normally, and thanks God, you know, in the U.S., in Switzerland, in other countries, we are in a free society where individual entrepreneurship is important and not like a state who tells you upside down what to do. I mean, I'll tell you without insulting it, but a city like Barcelona or other is easier to brand. You have a strong government. The government has a lot of money. You know, he basically pushes it through. Now, we have different situations here in market-oriented, laissez-faire countries like the U.S., Switzerland, and other countries, where you have to convince people. You have to invite people. So basically, our Phoenix project is invitation to participate on the one story, which we all agree that there's no other story. You know, there's always a little bit of a carrot and stick, but you make your own interpretation. And then we hope that by the time when tourism has a new campaign or a new marketing thing, which they need, you know, to do, what they show reflects what, you know, 500 miles away, a businessman from Phoenix tell his buddies over dinner or lunch in Denver or LA about Phoenix. And this is what we strongly believe.
Do you involve citizens in the development of the brand of their city?
Yes and no. Yes, there is always a bottom-up element to it. First of all, the workshops we do with the different stakeholders sometimes involve, you know, quite ordinary people. Probably, I remember a workshop we had in the West Valley. And, you know, there were people who were, I don't know, leading some citizen organizations or so. They were on the table. So they were actually discussing with us what they think, what their identity is under this Phoenix umbrella. And also in the implementation process, which again is very, you know, strongly crafted and is long term and it's very strategically done, there are always bottom up elements. For example, in Phoenix, we are now thinking about doing a postcard / YouTube thing about, you know, what is your opportunity oasis? So to start, what is your idea of this Phoenix story? So they're all elements. But I have to say, and this is why I said yes and no, the whole process in its general design, I think, still has a certain top-down element. I'm a strong advocate of bottom-up elements, and I think you need to involve the people, again, using your phrase, the city's talk back. But it still needs leadership. It needs leadership in important areas where people have also the long-term vision. And also, and this is very important, coming to my earlier point, they have the outside view. You know, ordinary citizens, which I understand completely, I'm also an ordinary citizen, you know, usually have shorter term or let's say more local views, kind of, you know, why should I care about the story of Phoenix when, I don't know, the grocery store next corner has bad opening hours or whatever, or whatever. So you need the leadership who looks beyond and also sees actually, well, we in Phoenix, as an example, Phoenix, you know, are in a global competition. The creative class people are not moving to Phoenix. They're moving to, I don't know, to Albuquerque or to San Diego and LA instead. So what are we going to do? Where do we want to be in 5 years from now? These are things who worry probably people who are dealing with this every day more than the ordinary citizen who definitely wants a nice image, you know, who doesn't want to come from a city who has a bad reputation. But what is very important, our approach seems very, let's say, comprehensive, but it doesn't solve, you know, everyday problems. What it does, though, and this is also very important, I like to make this point, is it gives a direct link to urban development, economic development, because for too long, these areas have been completely done parallel to each other with no connection. So there were urban planners who were doing a nice, you know, urban planning idea. Then there was the economic development strategy dealing with clusters and which, you know, which businesses to grow. And then was the branding / city marketing thing, which did another thing. And we're trying to almost create an intermediate so these different elements can start to talk under one story.
Mm-hmm. I think you have a fabulous approach. Let's talk about the approach that we saw from Abu Dhabi in our panel discussion there. We saw the new brand work. And the central idea there surprised me. The Abu Dhabi brand is built around the concept of respect. Do you think that will resonate beyond the UAE and the Middle East?
Well, it's a very good question. I think at one point I was very struck by the idea of respect because I could see that they really worked it out. It wasn't just a slick thing of Abu Dhabi, we are the greatest, or Abu Dhabi, let's come and experience the world, or whatever, this type of thing. Or what did you say? Baltimore is better, or so yeah, exactly. Yeah. Or you know, Toronto unlimited. You know, everything is unlimited. I think this was very good. So they confined themselves. They brought it down to a central, let's say, word, and also, quite in our way, using it not as a word to brand or tagline it, but more like as a working model or as a strategy model, which I liked. The difficulties or the problems or the challenges I see, especially in the Gulf region, is you go 50 or 100 miles away from Abu Dhabi, you come to Doha, the capital of Qatar, or to Bahrain, or to Dubai, and they will tell you more or less the same. So the difficulties I see there is that there's a typical case of the branding might be quite interesting, and I think although they have still a lot of visual elements, I think it's a step further than the normal branding is. It was developed a lot of also citizen input. It is also a long-term approach, so I quite liked it. The difficulty is, what is my differentiator? And I'm challenging Abu Dhabi by saying respect is probably a very important theme or story for the entire region there. And it's an overriding theme, almost like you would say probably you have a theme of entrepreneurship or in the US and let's say history, rich history in Europe. So I'm questioning if what would Qatar or even Dubai and Bahrain saying to respect, they would say, well, yes, this is also our theme. So my question to them, my challenge to them would be, respect is in the core, I understand this, But now, what is your take on respect? Because one danger they're running all in the Gulf regions, they're running all the same direction. They're all doing the cultural districts with their mega architectural museums. And as the Abu Dhabi person was speaking about this, you know, the Qatar person would have said the same. They're all running into these tourism mega palaces, mega hotels. They're all running into these kind of business hubs combined with, let's say, Formula One and sports. So I call it kind of the race to the bottom. At one point, they will wake up and say they don't differentiate. We all know from, you know, from our business education, if you don't differentiate, usually it will be solved by price. So the cheapest or the best value will survive, but there's no real distinction. So yes and no, the respect is an interesting topic. It's an interesting story. But is it enough in a region where respect has been a very old and very important element anyway?
One more question, Thomas. You're headquartered in Zurich. You have offices in California. Like a growing number of people, you're working globally. Does any place feel like home to you?
Well, it's interesting. You know, I'm also one of these people who are in Switzerland. We call them secondo because the second generation, my parents escaped from Czechoslovakia and went to Switzerland. I was born in Switzerland. So, you know, what is my home place? I think probably it is still Zurich, where I spent, the quality time. Although we are right now in the process of having a stronger presence here in Los Angeles, because we strongly believe that the U.S. and also the Asian market, where L.A. would be very, you know, well positioned for us, is actually growing in areas of long-term identity and branding work. So a typical pre-Lehman Brother answer would be, I feel at home at Plains, but you shouldn't do this nowadays. It sounds very yuppie. It sounds very investment banker, so I'm not saying this. I think it is still, Switzerland has qualities, but I think the combination of, you know, Zurich as almost like a perfect place, nice, intelligent city, and LA as being one of the world's, you know, most exciting, diverse, also strange and sometimes, you know, in good and bad avant-garde cities. I think the combination is very nice. So it's been a lot of traveling. It is traveling. It's fine. I'm a very curious person. And I think every person who is in the business of cities and countries need to travel. And I'm following your Twitter, Carolyn. And I mean, it's impressive since Abu Dhabi, where you've been. And I think this is very important. This is not, it's not just no only fun, but this is really to understand how different people think about cities and identities. And I think this opens up the outside view and enables me to see probably a region like the Gulf, as we were talking about, or Phoenix or other areas, a little bit with a different perspective. By the way, this was exactly the reason why Phoenix chose us. Okay, yes, we are across, you know, we are 50 minutes away in LA, but we have the European view, which probably is a little bit different than if we would just come from Phoenix or Albuquerque.
Thomas, I think you're bringing a very important perspective, new perspective to branding places, and I appreciate getting a chance to talk with you about it. Thanks so much for being our guest on Smart City.
Oh, it's a pleasure.
Thomas Sevcik is the CEO of Arthesia, a creative studio based in Zurich and now in Los Angeles. Finally this week, is the recession just a frame of mind? This week, our City Views commentator Walker Smith issues a call to arms to help get ourselves out of our national financial malaise.
You'd never know there is a severe recession going on by the packed crowds in the restaurants and bars in my neighborhood. But it sure is going on, as we see all around us these days. I was with some friends at one of these neighborhood restaurants the other night, and it was no less crowded than it had been a year ago. As we looked around the crowd, one of my friends said to me that he is, quote-unquote, refusing to participate in the recession. Good for him. And shame on all of us with jobs and some degree of job security for not locking arms with him as fellow recession refuseniks. Seriously, shame on us. As John Maynard Keynes noted decades ago in his articulation of the paradox of thrift, an idea that has been newly rediscovered of late, the worst possible thing anyone can do in a recession is to stop spending money. When people stop spending, the economy grinds to a halt, and so the money saved is just never enough to protect anyone's personal downside during such a downward economic spiral. What seems to be the smart thing to do is simply not that smart at all. There is a time to save money, and saving money is good during that time. But that time is not now. The way to get out of a recession is to spend our way out of it. And those of us who can afford to do so must keep spending. This is precisely what President Obama is trying to accomplish through his stimulus package. Get Americans spending again. We need to be evangelists, spreading this message to those who can afford it. In a word, spend. It is not only the best thing for ourselves, it is the best thing for the economy, and thus the best thing for all of those who are out of work. This notion of Keynes is now getting lots of press, but I was most impressed by commentator Ben Stein's call for spending by those who are still able to afford to do so on a CBS Sunday morning show that aired just before Christmas. In no uncertain terms, Stein said, quote unquote, "Now is the time to get out there and buy something and keep our fellow Americans employed. If we wait for the bureaucrats to do it, it will take too darn long. If we do it ourselves, it will get done." Bravo, Ben. In my neighborhood, at least, people are out en masse pouring money into the restaurants and bars. But none of us can put our wallets away just yet. We need to spend more and at more kinds of places. And if you're still working, that means you too. For City Views, this is Walker Smith.
Walker Smith is president of the Yankelovich Monitor, a trend service of the Futures Company. He joins us each week from Georgia Public Radio in Atlanta, and his latest book is Generation Ageless. There's more Smart City waiting for you online. Go to smartcityradio.com to download past shows, sign up for our newsletter, and get links to our guest work. You can subscribe to our podcast and have Smart City delivered straight to you. You can also get in touch with us. Click on the contact button or send email to questions@smartcityradio.com. Let us know how we're doing. Smart City's web content and audio archive are supported by CEOs for Cities, and national distribution is made possible by the Hyde Family Foundations, investing in programs that generate lasting change to improve the future of Memphis, Tennessee, and its citizens. For more information, visit HydeFoundations.org. Scotty Iseri is our producer and engineer. He's been with us officially for 1 year this week. What do you want, a medal? I'm Carol Coletta.